I call this meeting of the Senate Community and Regional Affairs to order. For the record, it is 3:30 p.m. Thursday, March 14th, 2019. We're in the Belts Room of the Tom Stewart Building. We have a quorum to do business. We have Senators Costello, Senators Birch, Senator Bishop, Senator Greg Jackson. Senator Hoffman is away on other state business. Today, I'd like to recognize staff here today, and that would be Christopher Dickrell from Senate Records. Good afternoon, sir. Eric Heimberger from the LIO and Cody Grusendorf from our office. We know the cell phone drill. Today's agenda, we have one item, and that's the road belt intertie. We have Jason Hoke here today with us from Copper Valley Development Association, and John Duhamel from the Copper Valley Electric Association. And we do have some invited testimony after the two presenters have finished. First off, I'd like to start and welcome Jason Hoke to the committee. And would you please introduce yourself for the record? And he's going to kick off, and then we're going to go to Mr. Duhamel, and he's going to present, and we'll go from there. So let's start with Mr. Hoke, and go ahead and introduce yourself, and please start.
Thank you, Chair. My name is Jason Hoke. I've been the regional arter through the Department of Commerce, Community and Economic Development for the Copper Valley for the last 10 years. We're a quasi-governmental that worked to advocate as a liaison between public and private business, as well as state and federal government. I also am the programs director for OTNA Intertribal Resource Commission, in charge of energy and biomass resource. Thank you very much for seeing us today, and this is something that I'm pretty passionate about. Thank you. All right, this is not Rivet's first rodeo. All right, this has been around for a while, folks. We didn't just think this ourselves. Back in the 80s, it was studied. It was studied real hard back in the 90s, and actually, I think this legislature even partially funded it to some degree. I think it was even looked at by Alaska Energy Authority when they were looking at Susitna-Wantana Dam as possibly running this line as well. Copper Valley Electric is kind enough to have everything that's ever been written on Rivet and studied published on their website, which is here in the report.
Mr. Hoke, just for those that are listening at home, this is the Road Belt Intertie, and Rivet will be the acronym that we'll use here today. So thank you.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Wait, don't sound like a frog.
Frog.
All right. The current project proposal, the transmission runs, we broke it up into two phases. Phase one would be from Sutton to Glen Allen to Delta Junction, approximately 286 miles. And that would be the 138 kilovolt to 245 kilovolt range, somewhere in there. Phase two is Gakona to Tok to Delta. That's approximately 227 miles at about 65 kilovolts. This could utilize all of the pre-existing ROWs. So where MEA runs out and Copper Valley Electric comes in, where AP&T runs out and Golden Valley runs down, there's only about 100 miles in gaps in all of that span between the lines. So we're not reinventing the wheel. We're not going to be breaking down new territory. We're looking at something that's already existing. It completes a bus loop around the road system for the interior of Alaska to connect to the rail belt. What's a bus loop? Well, power can go one way or it can come back another. You have an avalanche someplace along the rail belt, well, we can pipe it up the other way. And conversely.
Committee members, excuse me, sir. Committee members, you want to ask questions, just feel free. Just grab my attention.
Okay. We're talking about, you know, electrifying an area the size of Montana. You know, last year this was heard in Senate Energy and Resource Committee with Senator Murkowski, and I think folks were kind of taken back that we have an area that large with so many small microgrids.
Senator Gray Jackson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a question. And when you talk about road as opposed to rail belt, it seems pretty simple, you know, but I need a little bit of clarification.
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr.
Chairman. Chair. The road belt is following the road system that has been pre-established. The rail belt, they came up with that term, I don't know how many years ago, when they built it, that goes along the railroad there. We're talking about following the road. This map, it's kind of hard to see.
If I could interject really quick, Mr. Chairman, before you continue. Okay, some years ago, I put together the Alaska Rail Board Energy Authority on behalf of MLMP, Chugach Electric, and Golden Valley Electric, and, you know, the term was rail belt. And that's the reason why I'm asking the question about the term road belt as opposed to rail belt. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Well, to the chair, I don't know, we follow the road. You guys follow the rail, we follow the road.
Okay. All right. Good enough. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. As you can see, phase one running along the road, past Eureka to Glen Allen on up to Delta Fort Greeley. After that, phase two would be following the Tok cutoff up to Tok and on to Delta Junction, creating an additional loop. If you look at the larger map, you can see that there is also a number of potential mining sites, a lot of renewable energy sites, and all of the pump stations that could be served, military bases that may be served, as well as all of the communities that are sitting on island microgrids.
I'd just like to make a comment on the mining sites. And those are in historical mining districts. So this, if these bigger mines opened, it's not a one-off. It's already got a history of mining for the last 100-plus years.
Yes, sir.
Thank you. Senator Birch.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is like back to the future for me, because I remember Ramona Barnes and the Rail Belt Energy Fund, and I was actually on the assembly in Fairbanks when we were having a lot of discussion about this as a potential, and I really see some merit in the proposal. I also worked with Alaska Pipeline. If I remember, they retired one of the pump stations, and did the turbines stay in? Are they part of the? Are they tied in with Copper Valley now, or is it how did that? I'm just wondering where that plugs in the map. I'm just looking at your map.
I believe you're talking about Pump Station 12, but I will let John Duhamel, after he introduces himself, answer that, sir.
Thank you. John Duhamel, Copper Valley Electric Association. I'm the Chief Executive Officer. So through the chair to Senator Birch, the Pump Station 12 was semi-retired by Alyeska some time ago. We do provide power to them. It is more of a pass-through station now. I believe it's unmanned. There may be a small contingent of folks, but pretty much it's a pass-through area. But they do consume a considerable amount of power.
Yep. Follow up. Yeah, I was just gonna. I recall when they. I think it was shortly after I left Alyeska. They were going through a plan to electrify most of the stations and get off of the turbines off of on site. Jet fuel or producing with the topping plants, but it's an exciting program, and I'm glad to see you here talking it up here. Look forward to following this. Thanks. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
You're welcome.
Thank you, sir. Yes, as you'll notice, Pump Station 8 and 9 are both isolated, standalone facilities generating power. One thing that I didn't put on this map, and it's just interesting to say since there's a seems to be quite a buzz about educational funding, is the HARP site, which is owned by the university now. They burn 600 gallons of fuel per hour while fired up. And that's considerable savings to the university system, by the way, if this were to go through. Planning. You know, I'm a firm believer in the five Ps. It's six Ps in the Marine Corps, but five piece for public testimony. Proper planning prevents poor performance. And we have planned and vetted this thing through and through, not just in my region, but in other regions. Copper Valley Regional Energy Plan with Alaska Energy Authority, this was the number one priority. In the statewide energy plan with AEA, this was number three in the top priorities. Copper Valley Regional SEDS, which is a comprehensive economic development strategy with the U.S. EDA. This was a top priority. The statewide SEDS done with the U.S. EDA and the Alaska Division of Economic Development, a top priority. The Otna Tribal Energy Plan, number one priority. Tanana Chiefs Conference, top priority. Tanana Chiefs SEDS, top priority. And also, I just found out the other day, Fairbanks North Star Borough has listed this as a top priority in their comprehensive economic development strategy. It's on page 4 and 5 of their document, by the way, if you're interested. Support and resolutions. You know, I said a long time ago when we had an energy conference down our way that energy is the tie that binds. You know, when it's squeezing us all, we all seem to come together as Alaskans and try and fix it. So AFN had its only energy resolution of 2017 was the Road Belt Intertie. Native organizations that are impacted and feeling this squeeze, we have 12 tribal governments, 12 village corporations, 4 ANSCAs, Otna Intertribal Resource Commission, Tanana Chiefs Conference, Copper River Native Association. We even have a letter of support supporting these efforts from the Native Village of Chickaloon and many, many more. Copper Valley Electric, AP&T, MEA, Golden Valley, and the Alaska Power Association itself have all signed board resolutions supporting these efforts. The regional ARTA is in support of it. The Chamber of Commerce for Copper Valley is in support of it. And we've had meetings and discussions along the road system with the communities that are impacted with this. You know, I think part of the problem back in the 90s was I don't think people went and talked to folks. Hey, how do you feel about this? Where do you want it to go? And we've made a point, the COO for Copper Valley Electric and myself have traveled to most of these communities and saw how they felt. And getting that input and saying that, hey, we're here to work with you. I mean, I wouldn't want that running a big tension line run through my backyard, nor would you. And saying we're willing to work with folks. 97% of all business deals are negotiable. It's only 3% that's non-negotiable. I think there's things that could be negotiated and worked out, and that's what part of the engineering process and report is all about. Current costs and consumptions in hitting development. Most communities in this project area are paying 300 to 500% more than the national average. The national average is 12 cents per kW. Okay? That's an awful lot. For instance, down in Chitna, they're paying 88 cents a kW. That's a hefty cost. Communities are electrified by multiple microgrids. They consume approximately 4 million gallons of diesel per year in this area that we're discussing. Emissions and other issues plague these small grids. You know, a lot of times out in the Slant area or something, generator goes out. It's going to be a long time before they can get somebody there to work on it. PCE does not cover commercial electricity, which is 60% of all electrical consumption in these communities. What is that 60%? That 60% is Alaska paid for school districts, which is a huge consumer of it, DOT facilities, university facilities, as mentioned before, small businesses, post office. So 60% of that is in one way, shape, or form coming out of your budgets. Electrical costs directly correlate to business and resident closure and relocation. You know, we've had a number of folks and businesses have to pull stakes and move out. Economic and natural resource development. Cheaper electrical power opens the door for BRE, business retention and expansion. You know, Mr. Pop with AEDC asked me what I'm doing for economic development. Getting energy costs down. We can't have business growth in our regions without cheaper energy. Jamie Murundi, who currently works for Doyon, and she's president of the Northway Corporation, has written 8 business plans. None of them pencil out because of the cost of electricity on that microgrid. It is necessary infrastructure for economic development. I know you've been involved with economic development for quite a while. That is the number one inhibitor we have in this state, is the cost of energy for economic development. Lumber, timber industry, for instance, we had an OSB manufacturer interested in starting up out in my neck of the woods in Glen Ellen area. Didn't pencil out. The Three Bears in Glen Ellen didn't pencil out. We have multiple other things queued up, biomass plants for bricks and pellets, lumber mills. They just won't happen without this. Mining operations that could benefit, Fort Knox, Pogo, they're already existing. They could benefit significantly from cheaper power, keep people working for years to come. The Stellar Mine, Attell Creek Mine, Tetlin Mine, and 4th of July Creek Mine are four, as we indicated earlier, mines that are in historical mining districts that could benefit from this cheap power, creating jobs. Ooh, and one other thing, probably some revenue for the state, perhaps. Tourism, fishing, transportation. You know, the city of Valdez just significantly expanded its port and has plans to even put more in there. Samson Barge and Tug was boasting how they have 720 plugs now on the port for keeping the Conexes refrigerated and full of fish heading south. Well, that's a lot of power, and we need to keep that power cost down. One thing I did forget on here was agriculture. You know, we have Tonsina North is an agricultural area set up by the state of Alaska. The federal government actually paid $2.7 million to divert the pipeline underground to get heavy equipment over it. That was in 2002. Here we are, 2019. Well, this has come to fruition, but those folks are off-grid. Right, if we can build this, we can stretch out line to them, and we can get them on-grid and help develop agriculture. Besides that, food hubs and other processing facilities require massive amounts of electricity as well. And we already have discussed the Alyeska pipeline benefits. Here's the big kahuna. Military benefits. Energy is national security. Military bases benefiting from the Road Belt Intertie, Black Rapids Training Facility, Donley Dome Range, Fort Greeley, Eielson Air Force Base, Fort Wainwright, and Clearwater Air Force Base. All of these places are in dire need for more power. Last year, I had the privilege of meeting three-star General Wilsbach, commander of PACCOM at the time. He was all in. Yep, we need power. And I started working with the staff. Unfortunately, maybe fortunately for him, the general's moved on now. But it's a conversation that I wish to continue. This is redundant and reliable energy that is necessary. Currently, there's an 80-megawatt bottleneck at Eva Creek on the rail belt. Ribbit offers a redundant loop with more power capacity. reduced costs for the military with cheaper energy and redundancy. Signs of continued defense buildup and growth are coming and coming and coming. And if you don't believe it, just hang out the hub there at the corner of the Richardson and Glen Highway and watch the Army trucks go by. The other thing, too, is 25% renewable need. The military is under mandate to have 25% renewable for most of their funding. And RIBIT opens up renewable energy resources. Some other information, a hierarchy and ease infrastructure. I see the three big things for infrastructure is energy, transportation, and communication. Right now on the road belt, we already have two of the three. We have the road for transportation, and we have the communication. We have fiber optic line through most of this country that I've showed, as well as 4G cell in most of that area. So what's lacking? Cheap energy. New energy and economic development means new revenues for the state. I know that's a big deal coming up. Our region, both those regions, both the Upper Tanana and Copper Valley, are unorganized boroughs. And I don't see that changing anytime soon. What does that mean? That means that you are our governing body. We come to you for aid and assistance. And I'm asking that you consider this and supporting this down the road at some time as we move forward. This is also about people making hard choices. You know, 22 years ago, I came to this state as a teacher and administrator in Chistochina, small one-room classroom, and now I'm seeing some of my former students making that choice between groceries or paying the electric bill. Do I stay here in my home village, or do I move to Wasilla or down to Seattle, California, where things are a little cheaper and easier? You know, it's not just about industry. This is about people.
Senator Birch.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Your point regarding the area being an unorganized borough and the legislature serving as your governing body, are you detecting any appetite for a mill rate assessment in the unorganized borough equivalent to what Anchorage and Fairbanks might have?
No, sir.
Oh, okay.
Through the chair.
I always get that you know the legislature through the chair is always set up as a body, and having served on the assembly in both Fairbanks and in Anchorage and set, you know, established mill rates to provide schools and infrastructure and those kind of things, I've never detected any appetite on the unorganized borough for any sort of a mill rate assessment. But.
No, sir. Actually, the legislature gets, the state of Alaska gets approximately $34 million a year for the pipeline running through the Copper Valley.
Yeah, we're talking about that right now, as you might expect. Thank you. Thank you.
Please continue, sir.
Thank you. So what do we need? We need support from the Alaska State Legislature. I've been working on a recon study. That's basically an engineer's report or a shopping list. Estimated the whole gambit, soup to nuts, is $2 million. Phase one would probably be a little bit less than $1 million because most of it's already been done by Copper Valley Electric earlier. The outcome of this proposed reconnaissance would give us an actionable document, something I can take, we can take to the congressional delegation. total cost of the project estimates, $200 to $300 million for phase one. That's about two F-22s. Phase two is about $100 million. That's equivalent to one Abrams tank. Where is this coming from? We're broke. I've heard this already here. Well, it's expected that the U.S. Department of Defense, Department of Agriculture, Energy, Interior, Commerce, along with some state agencies, could be approached to contribute towards this project, as well as any beneficiary utilities, communities, and other organizations. One idea was to possibly set up an account. I talked to acting interim co-chair John Torgerson, who was open to the idea of setting something up at Denali Commission, perhaps. But I think with your support, verbal or otherwise written, I think we're going to go pretty far. Ribbit, Road Belt Intertie, Kermit the Frog. Questions, comments, cries of outrage.
Senator Gray Jackson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So here's my cry of outrage. Just kidding. So anyway, what I want to know is, because you talk about this last paragraph, where's it coming from? And you say, would it be approached? So the federal government hasn't been approached yet?
To some degree, we've discussed it. Yes.
To how much degree?
Well, I believe Senator Murkowski had assisted in the hearings last year with the Office of Indian Energy. However, the federal definition of Indian country inhibited any money from being spent on energy going across not other lands besides Native-owned lands. That was one part. The other part is Mr. Chad Stovall with the USDA Innovation Center is coming out in a month to talk to some utilities, both telecom and electric, about some of the programs that the feds are coming out with for building infrastructure that is concordantly running broadband, fiber, and transmission lines. The USDA has been approached last year, fall. I had dinner with Ann Haslett, Assistant Secretary of USDA RD, briefed her on the project. She thinks it's a great project. We have to see what's going to happen, what's going to shake loose. You know, there's others I can keep going if you want.
Well, I'd like to hear it, if I may, Mr. Chairman.
Floor is yours.
Thank you.
Okay. I've discussed this with Assistant Secretary of the Interior, Joe Baelish. I met with him on several occasions regarding multiple different sources of possible funding. When I did meet with Acting Co-Chair John Torgerson, he said that an account could be set up for a project in which multiple federal agencies, through different projects and program funding, could possibly contribute towards this. I was also in D.C., saw the Office of Electrification with the Department of Energy. They're very interested and do have programs that possibly could contribute towards this. The other thing that is possible is in working with Senator Sullivan's office, Assistant Secretary of Defense Niemeyer during his confirmation hearings had indicated, which I have that document, he would be working with folks involved with the Road Belt Intertie if that infrastructure was necessitated for the military. And quite frankly, I see this as, that's the, in my opinion, the number one need right now. We need to support our military, support the defense of America, and help out the bases. Yes, this is a people need as well. Yes, this is a need for industry and commerce. But I think, in my personal opinion, ma'am, that is the number one need right now.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, can I just continue for a quick moment? I just have a comment to make.
Yes, ma'am.
No, I really appreciate hearing how far you've gone with reaching the federal government, because I don't think this is just a good project. It's a much-needed project. And a lot of us, you know, who don't experience the high cost of energy, maybe sometimes don't realize, you know, how significant and urgent this is. And I worked for the city of Accutan, so I know the cost of energy in rural Alaska. So I really appreciate you bringing this forward. And thank you very much for your presentation. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
Senator, okay. Jason, thank you. And Mr. Duhamel, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Jason's responsibility was to carry about 90% of the water, and my role in this is really only about 10%, and my role is actually the validation from the utility community. So as I sit before you today, I'm actually wearing a few hats. Of course, I'm the CEO of Copper Valley Electric Association, but I'm also a director on the board of directors for the Alaska Power Association, which Jason said earlier has already sanctioned the project and submitted a resolution from the board to Jason and actually the stakeholders in this concept of a project. And I'm also the chairman of the APA Hydropower Group, and so I kind of represent hydropower interests as well as I sit before you today. So we, as the community of utilities, obviously support this project quite heavily. As Jason said earlier, resolutions were submitted from MEA and Golden Valley. Those are the two utilities that butt up against Copper Valley Electric. So we're all, I believe, in this together and see this as a good project. Before I get into some of the technical details, and I'm not going to go too technical, I do want to talk about how utilities label power. When we move power around, we either move it through distribution systems, we call distribution power, or transmission systems, we call transmission or sub-transmission power. Under a distribution system, we use lower voltages. That's where we push power to the end user, a residential customer, commercial, or in some cases industrial. And distribution power is managed by utilities. It's not something that we consider as a state or federal infrastructure, but certainly the utility takes care of that. Transmission power is a little bit different. These are high voltages with very large lines or conductors that we call them, big structures to keep them up in the air. And they're expensive, and that's kind of why when Jason throws some numbers out there, and of course those numbers are very cursory, what this, the first thing we would do, a reconnaissance study, would determine some accuracy in those numbers. But those numbers are large because we are talking about these high voltage structures to move large amounts of power to different communities. And we do that from substation to substation. In Alaska, we do have utilities that manage transmission, but the state also manages a section of transmission as well. One of the, probably the most important things that Jason said here today, and boy, I like to try to beat the drum as much as I can, is transmission is infrastructure. Most people clearly see that airports are infrastructure, that roads are infrastructure, but they don't necessarily look at moving power as infrastructure. And when we're moving power from one utility to another, from one community to another, it really is a role bigger than the utility, either a state role or a federal role. So our vision with the Road Belt Intertie is it's transmission only, and with some sub-transmission, and it would be state-managed. This is just a real simple pictorial of what I'm talking about. Transmission, those are the big structures. The top of the picture shows a power plant moving big power into substations. We usually move power in standard voltages. In this particular case, the standard voltage would probably be in the 230, 138,000 volt range, or it could be moved through high voltage DC as well. There's many options there, and as I said, we will determine what those look like exactly if we're able to move on with a reconnaissance study. The transmission, that's when you're moving a little bit less power, so you use a smaller voltage. In the case here, I just showed some standard sub-transmission voltages, 69 to 45,000 volts. And then when you get down to distribution, as I said, getting to the end user, we're down in the 14.4 and 7.2 thousand volt range. And then from there, we run it into a transformer near your house and drop it into home or commercial voltage ranges. A few other things I want to describe about utilities that'll help the discussion is a grid. What is a grid? It's just a network of power lines that are all interconnected. The bigger the grid, the more resilient it becomes. And this is important. If you have a small grid, a small fluctuation can bring the entire system down. So, for example, in Copper Valley Electric, one tree could take the entire system down, which means that 3,800 customers go out of power because of one tree. If you're connected into a large grid or a massive grid, like down in the lower 48, it would hardly even see a blip on the system when a tree gets into the line. So in addition to the resiliency, we're giving a better product to the customers. So a more reliable service, and we're able to adapt to any problems or breaks in the transmission or distribution system, the bigger the grid. That also relates to our ability to absorb more renewable energy. Renewable energy, especially in the wind and solar area, it does fluctuate. You know, for solar, clouds do roll in, they roll out. For wind does change, it gusts. And what that does is it makes that energy variable. Variable energy is still good energy, but we want to be able to control those fluctuations. The bigger the grid, the more we can control those fluctuations, and that means we can allow more renewable. So a very good thing happens with that bigger grid in the renewable area. Also, as Jason mentioned, power moves in any direction. So if we loop feed our transmission around the state, a break anywhere in the loop means we can reroute power and bring power back around from the other direction. And that means, again, reliability goes up. Customers don't have the outages. Even with a major transmission line going down, when you build out your grid like this and make it a more extensive grid, you can adapt to the problems much easier. So it's better for everyone. And then there's also the quantity of scales, and this is pretty important, because I don't want it to come across that this project only benefits the area that the project's claiming. It actually benefits everywhere. So if for example, a generator in Anchorage can run more efficiently because it's feeding more customers, then the base costs are spread out over more people. It brings costs down. So not only does it do a great thing for our area, it actually brings costs down in the rail belt as well. So, as Jason mentioned, this concept's not new. I did this just to show you that it was legitimately looked at in the past. I pulled this page out of the Alaska Energy Policy Task Force from 2003, and you can see, just as Jason mentioned, we have a solid line that represented by the dark black line from Fairbanks all the way down to Homer, and then we have dotted lines moving into the area of the project that we're here before you talking about. The picture here that Jason had up earlier, I kind of want to key in on it, because I drew a rectangle on there. That rectangle I call the window of opportunity. Everybody inside that rectangle, which Jason says is the size of Montana, I haven't checked, but I'm going to trust that because it is a big area. They all have isolated grids. They're generating their own power, or they have no power at all. So this project would bring that all together. And that would be a wonderful thing for our area. It would be a wonderful thing for that side of the Richardson Highway.
I had a question on that map.
Senator Birch.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On the prior slide, the map area, I guess the question relates to, I attended the Pacific Northwest Energy Lab in Richland, Washington last summer, and they had a control room where they showed, you know, everything, you know, what was out of phase, and it kind of did some fascinating stuff. But to reinforce your view as far as the redundancy and having a loop there, what role are in the changes that have happened in the high voltage direct current line? I know they've got one, I think it's out of Richland to Southern California, long distances, but can you tap into those, or does that have any potential with the technology that's changed over the last 15-20 years? Does that have a role here, or is everything AC and not DC? And I know probably just enough to be dangerous, but does DC have a potential of having a role in this at all? Through the chair
to Senator Birch, the technology is changing daily, and it's getting better. What would happen when we do the reconnaissance study, an electrical engineer would look at it, and they would make a determination on which one of those technologies would be best for the project. High voltage DC normally is best for moving over great distances and moving a lot of power. We probably don't have those kind of needs unless it was from the North Slope all the way down to the Anchorage Bowl. Then you might see a high voltage DC system. Probably not for this application, but I did in my initial discussion want folks to know that there are lots of options out there. But we will key in on the best option that moves energy with the most efficiency.
Great. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
You bet. Please continue, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So, just to kind of recap, and I don't want to duplicate a lot here, but the basic premise of the utilities and why we support this is grid resilience. We want to get that larger grid. It's good for all. There is an overcapacity right now. We have a lot of natural gas generation that we're not running at their full efficiency all the time, and part of that is because we don't have a lot of customers to push that power to. When we do set up a larger grid like this, we can better utilize those power plants. We can push the cheapest power plants keep them at their highest efficiency. So certainly we can take advantage of an overcapacity of generation. It brings together those isolated grids in that window of opportunity that I was talking about. Right now, those areas don't have choices. Many of the isolated or microgrids, as Jason said, in those areas, they got one choice. It's diesel. It's expensive. It's difficult. There's a lot of emissions with that. If we were able to tie them in, they get choices. They can run some of their own power. They can build renewable because now they have a grid that is more resilient and can absorb that renewable energy, or they can buy power right off the grid. And I can tell you, in our area, we would all love some of that real cheap natural gas that the Rail Belt puts out. So a very good thing for all those grids. As I said, the loop is really important as far as that reliability goes. It does give us more opportunity for renewable, and as you see and hear all the time, I think that the discussion at the federal arena is that they could set some goals for us, and those goals are not going to be achieved unless we have the ability to get more renewable energy into our system. It brings the cost of power down. So not only, as I said, not only does it bring the power cost of power down in the area, in that window of opportunity, it should bring the cost of power down in Anchorage. And you'd wonder, well, how can it bring it down in Anchorage when we're putting lines way out in Glen Allen and up the Richardson Highway? It's that quantity of scales that does that. And utilizing our power plants at their highest efficiency. So my last slide here is kind of just a list of why the utilities support the Road Belt Initiative. When we head to Washington and we try to get funding for this, because I think we all know that the state's not going to be able to fund this, and we're not expecting the state to fund this. We think there's, if we do our job right, we can convince federal agencies that this is something that's good for the state and a good utilization of infrastructure dollars. So your support of this gives credibility to the concept. It certainly helps us when we approach our congressional delegation, our federal departments up there with money, the White House, about getting our costs of energy down. It, again, grows our renewable opportunity. The legislative support helps in our request for federal funds. And it's a lot easier for us when we go in and we talk to DOD or the Department of Interior or Agriculture and say that, you know, here's documents from our legislative branches that are in full support of this. They know that it's not a controversial project, and I'm sure that they want to stay away from controversial projects. With legislative support, it kind of revitalizes a concept that we've already validated in the past, as Jason mentioned. And this certainly, I believe, puts us in a position where if infrastructure money does come out of the federal government or out of the White House or wherever infrastructure money shows up, we can waive this project and say this is infrastructure and this is great for Alaska, and we should move to the head of the line. So that's my 10% of water that I'm carrying. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Very good. Senator Birch.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. At one time, as I recall, Fort Greeley had a small, I don't know if it was a demonstration, it was a nuclear power plant. Did that generate power very wide, how widely distributed was that, or how, I never saw it personally, but I just understood that there was a small scale plant there, and I just was curious through the chair how that worked.
Through the chair to Senator Birch, as far as I know, it was a small nuclear project in Galena.
Wasn't Covina, no?
Can I answer that question?
Oh, go ahead, yes.
That was the first operational nuclear power plant in the United States. It was at Fort Greeley, Alaska. It provided power for the Fort Greeley military base and the Allen Army Airfield.
There you go.
Then certainly before my time. I do know there was a small nuclear plant in the Galena. Post. There was a
proposed?
Yeah, right.
Proposed.
Proposed. Oh, proposed. Okay. Yeah. I stand corrected.
Battery.
Thank you.
Battery.
Thank you.
Yeah. Toshiba 4S battery. Yeah.
Questions? Okay, so I've got a series of questions for Mr. Duhamel's done. Just I'll roll through these. The right-of-way, is it, so it would be going on the road belt, Ribbits. So the right-of-way, is it all acquired, or would we need to acquire some right-of-way? Do we know that?
Well, Mr. Chairman, that's certainly something that the reconnaissance study needs to do. I will tell you that, as Jason said, we have distribution right-of-way, like, for example, between Copper Valley Electric and MEA, that there only represents about a three-mile gap, but that's distribution. Transmission is different structures, and different requirements. Mm-hmm. Our distribution right-of-ways are 30 feet wide. Transmission right-of-ways are 100 feet wide. So you would have to readdress all the land agreements and pretty much reestablish those rights away. We could also look at utilizing road right-of-ways. Mm-hmm. We could utilize pipeline right-of-ways. So there's a lot of avenues there, and there is a lot of questions about right-of-way, and that's part of one of the reasons for a pretty big expense is in our estimates, we're including all that land work and right-of-way work that's necessary for a project like this. So certainly, to answer your question, there's a lot of right-of-way and possibly even some purchasing of lands that are necessary.
So with your professional background, a $2 million study, how will that get you 10%? How close will that get you on accuracy for a final FID decision, for a final investment decision?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. When you develop a project, you actually refine your estimate as you move along. That first step would get us in, and when you talk about estimates, we call them from a class one to a class five, where class one is not well defined and a class five is right on the money. It would get us into the class two, maybe class three area of accuracy in that initial reconnaissance study. But further, as we start to compete out contractors to do the work and go out for bids, that's when you really refine it. But it'll get us pretty close, I think, and pretty close can be defined in many ways, certainly within the 20-30%. Once we do the reconnaissance study.
So you don't have to answer this, but I want to see if you could ballpark a final investment decision, class five study. What would that cost us?
We're estimating between $1 to $2 million a mile. And certainly someone could stand there and say, you know, we just built our line for $200,000 a mile, but there are.
You're talking about the reconnaissance, weren't you?
Yeah, to do a class five study, project ready estimate, how much would that cost? Would it cost $50 million to do that? $25 million?
For the class five?
Yeah, study.
I don't know that I'm qualified to answer that because it would be further down. So, and sorry to be wishy-washy here, but. No, the reconnaissance study leads to what we call a pre-feasibility mm-hmm. study. The pre-feasibility study leads to the feasibility study. Mm-hmm. So when you get to the feasibility study stage, that's when you have electrical engineers defining where every structure is going to go. It defines the size of the line. It's going to define the size of the insulator. So that's when you start to get into the class five mm-hmm. estimate range. But we would not get there with the $2 million right. that we think is necessary for the, and so we would have to be into the past the pre-feasibility into the feasibility, And boy, for me to estimate that,
that's fine.
Maybe 50 million is in the parking lot. I'm not sure.
Okay, thank you. Just a range. Any other questions? Seeing none, we're going to go to our next presenter, and that is Mr. Bruce Kane, Copper Valley Chamber of Commerce and Otna Inc. So, is Mr. Kane online?
Yes, Chairman Bishop, can you hear me?
Yes, sir. Put your name and affiliation on the record. And
I'm Bruce Kane, and I live in Glen Allen, Alaska. I'll be speaking today on as the president of the Copper Valley Chamber of Commerce. And so,
thank you. The floor is yours. Continue.
Thank you, Chairman Bishop. So, yeah, my name is Bruce Kane, and I live out in Glen Allen, and I am the president of the Copper Valley Chamber of Commerce. We have about 200 business members that operate businesses in the Copper River, Copper Valley region, or have interest in the Copper River region because of travel through here or investments such as the pipeline. And I'm speaking in support of the road belt intertie. The Copper Valley Chamber of Commerce has designated this project, and I think Jason already mentioned this, but it's our number one priority for economic development. So we have that on the record as of 2017. And so that's really, I just wanted to, I think Jason and Mr. Duhamel covered the project pretty well, so I don't need to go into a lot of those details other than the one thing I did want to point out and reemphasize is that our business members operate businesses, and obviously, and businesses do not qualify for PCE. And so all of our members are paying that are off of the Copper Valley, the ones up the Oak Cutoff and in the Chittenden area. They're paying 72 cents. I think it was even up to a dollar a kilowatt hour for a while up in the AP&T grid there. It's down now, but that's a lot of money when you have a business you're trying to operate. And it was even, it was kind of a sad time when someone came to one of our chamber monthly dinner meetings and they asked, well, why don't our businesses have American flags up as much like we used to? And it was brought up by more than one member that the light it takes to light that flag at night in order to, do the regulations for the flag was a lot of money, and they had to make a choice, and so that they took their flags down, and so that's just a lot of other things happened too as well, but anyway that. I'm thankful that we're bringing this forward. I appreciate the energy. You're talking about energy, but the energy of Jason and Mr. Duhamel to just bring this project forward. We've been working on this for many, many years, and I've lived here in Glen Allen since 1980, I graduated from Lathrop High School in 1975 and met my wife up there at the University of Alaska. Graduated from Lathrop High School in 1975 along with some other significant Alaskan leaders. And I just wanted to just thank you for hearing this. And I did want to tell a story if I could, Mr. Chair. I won't take a lot of time on it. But in 1898, Lieutenant that we all think about 1898 and the Chilkoot Pass and the Gold Rush, but there was a group of army squadron. It was under Lieutenant Allen, but it was Lieutenant Kastner that was assigned the task of doing the reconnaissance. We're talking about reconnaissances here, and so in 1898 he was dropped off in Kinnick, and he ran a reconnaissance from Kinnick up the Matanuska Valley, up through Delta, which is the route of the road belt intertie we would be talking about. There was no road belt then. They went down the Delta, the Tanana River, then they went to Tanana and spent the winter there and came out to Skagway. But that took 5 months of perilous, just incredible, you know, the words that came describe what they went through to get from Cook Inlet up to Delta. And today, you can make that trip in less than a day in the comfort of a car. My wife got up yesterday morning at 6 in the morning, drove to Fairbanks, and you just didn't. It's nice to have them, and we're thankful for the visionaries back then that have brought that reconnaissance forward to what we have today. And we need to be thinking about the future, and we need to be thinking about what it will be like when we have that infrastructure in place for our children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren so that there is a better life. And so I think, you know, we need to be thinking more of, you know, not for what's here today, but what we have in the future. And I'm thankful for this committee and your leadership here with the state. And that's really all I have to say, is that the Copper Valley Chamber of Commerce is in full support of this. We need it very badly. We have very high costs, and it affects us in a lot of ways. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Kane, thank you for taking time to call in there today. Tell everybody hello from us here in the Copper Valley. And yes, it's we've got two Lathrop graduates talking to each other in class of 75, and I'm sitting next to my colleague, Senator Birch, and I believe his wife is a graduate of class of 75. So Lathrop did good that year. So seeing no other questions from committee members, any closing comments?
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to clarify something. I don't know if Mr. Duhamel was aware, but we did, in looking up that first initial recon step, we contacted Dryden and LaRue, which is an engineering firm that does transmission lines. We were kicking the tires, and we got a scope outline and an estimate that came into approximately $2 million for that first initial piece. Mm-hmm. As far as the other pieces Mr. Duhamel was discussing, I don't know the cost on those, but we can surely investigate that if you'd like.
Thank you. Okay, so seeing no other questions from committee members, thanks for the closing comments. Thanks for coming to do this. And next week, that will conclude today's presentation. So I'm going a little off script, on script, ad-libbing here for my committee members and Senate records. But this will conclude our meeting for today. We do have a meeting next Thursday, everybody, and that will be we're going to hear the governor's bill. Senate Bill 63, as it pertains to fish tax, repeal of municipal revenue refunds and revenue sharing. And I'd like to thank all our participants and the committee members today for attending. And we're going to gavel out at 4:28.